and let's get going.
So, you know, the introduction, we're just at the first page of the introduction, right? You guys, I figured out from the last class, you guys, on average, were born about 3 to 5 years after the Rodney King episode. But what's the point of him starting with Rodney King?
Because
That's a good point. Yeah, it's a moment where our inability to get along was revealed, and so his as the victim of this police beating, which I mean Rodney King was not an angel, okay, but you know he was. This was one of the first police beatings or police violence episodes that we caught on film, and it was. You know, at that point, the country wasn't used to this kind of idea, and it caused riots, as you learn from the book. People died, right? What, 50 people died, and thousands of buildings were in Los Angeles were torched. Are any of you, yeah, so you would have, if you're from Los Angeles, maybe your parents knew about this, right? So here's the point for us. Remember, Cooper identified ethics as a way of resolving value conflicts. And notice Haidt, so start your notes here. Like Cooper, Haidt sees ethics as a way of getting along, right? Ethics is a way of solving conflicts, right? And remember last time, we contrasted that with ethics as a way of finding moral truths, right? So Haidt is throwing his lot in with Cooper and those who see ethics. The problem of ethics is settling conflict. And one of the things about this book is that it's going to give you a lot of moral psychology, a lot of research results about how we actually operate with values. And so the claim in the first part of the book is going to be that intuitions come first and reasoning comes second. You got his rider-elephant metaphor already in the previous reading you did, but let's just contrast this. I'm going to ask you to kind of set this up. So this is Haidt and Cooper. And this is what a traditional philosopher would say. And I want you to appreciate how radical this gesture is, but then we're going to sort it out. For a traditional philosopher, reason comes first. And it's reason that you use to figure out what's morally true. And then you should train your emotions and intuitions around that. So for traditional philosophers, it's reason first, intuitions, question mark. It's not clear that for a traditional philosopher, intuitions and emotion get in the way. Remember the charioteer metaphor, right? Remember that from last time? The charioteer is Plato's metaphor of consciousness, where the charioteer is reason and control of the horses. The horses don't contribute anything. They just need to be controlled. Haidt's doing something really weird. He's sort of saying the elephant speaks first. And often reason gives ad hoc, that means come up with it at the moment, ad hoc justifications. So this is kind of weird. I mean, he's doing something very different from traditional moral philosophers. But I don't want you to see it as too direct a contrast, because he's also doing something different at the level of metaethics. What he's offering is explanations. And I'll fill this in for your notes. What he's going to offer in this book is explanations of how moral psychology works. What philosophers have traditionally offered is justifications. Theories which help us give justifications. Right? So what is it when you justify something? What you do is you give reasons for believing or doing something, right? So add that into your notes. Justifications. Reasons for believing C, where C is the conclusion of an argument. Premise, conclusion, right? Remember that from critical thinking? When you give explanations, what you're doing is explaining how something works.
how it works. And that also has a premise-conclusion structure. There's the thing you're trying to explain, thing being explained, and then there's the explanation. And here, there's the reasons given for the belief or action, and here, it's the belief or action. Right? So, let's see if we can get this in your notes.
Take a minute and get this in your notes.
And I'll draw a couple of conclusions about it. Okay, so, Haidt is doing something radically different from philosophers, because philosophers have traditionally thought that it was that we're going to figure out morality using our faculty of reason. And notice, I mean, traditionally philosophers have thought of reason as non-cultural, universal, same for all thinkers. Doesn't matter whether you come from a first world, second world, developing country, doesn't matter whether you were 3,000 years ago or now. Theoretically, most traditional philosophers thought the way you do morality is you use reason to come up with really good justifications for beliefs and actions. And you remember, our example so far is Singer. Singer is the utilitarian, right? So there's the, can anybody remember, go back in your notes here. What was the principle of utility? Somebody give me the principle of utility, please. Yeah. So great, that's what you need for your notes. Greatest good for greatest number. Up arrow, good, up arrow, number. Well, however you want to appreciate that. A little more elaborate. We ought to always act to promote the greatest good for the greatest number, right? So that's a principle for giving justifications, right? Traditional philosophers didn't think you needed to explain morality because it was about reasoning. Yeah, Laura.
Could you just read what the reason, I'm thinking that's reason.
Sure. Second. Intuitions first, reason second.
Yeah, the thing that
ad hoc justification. So what he's saying is
also that also says justification.
Well, what he's saying is that in our psychology what we do is reason often comes to the aid of our intuitions to provide support. Okay. Remember the example last time is if my wife says, you know, why didn't you clean the dishes? I immediately come up with a justifying answer. Oh, I'm busy. I mean, don't you see? I'm pretty busy this week. Come on. No. So reason's like your inner lawyer. Okay. So Haidt's doing something really different from philosophers. Philosophers didn't traditionally think you needed to explain where morality came from or how it works. They just thought you needed to use reason to come up with good justification. And so that's kind of an important contrast. It's also important. We'll add a little more to this. But that's basically what that introduction kind of gives us. Is that in studying ethics this way, we need to start by getting a good account of how we operate as humans. How do we operate with values? And that's a how story. So that's what most of this book is about. What Haidt believes is that if you have really good explanations for how it works, then you'll be able to give better justifications, right? So he's not, put this in your notes, he's not saying that we shouldn't offer justifications for our moral beliefs. He's just saying traditionally philosophers haven't really understood what's going on in ethical, in moral experience. So their justifications are kind of abstract and detached. We still need utilitarians and other theories. We're going to get to that. Okay. Questions about that? Is that good? Okay. Now here's the rich chapter, right? This is our bigger content challenge, and here's where we're going to want to kind of listen for this story that he's telling about the progress of these disciplines, right? So you learn here. Let me see. I need a little room. Let's produce this together, okay? So I'm going to ask you to follow this in the book. My page numbers don't exactly line up with yours. I'm sorry about that. So he's telling you a story about the history of developmental psychology and the history of moral psychology. So let's get our disciplines listed here. Developmental psych, moral psych. What other disciplines come into play in chapter one? We got Schwader. What's his discipline? Anthropology. Okay, turn those pages, guys. Let's remind yourself of what was in there. I want you to help me produce this. So really, he's telling you about the history of these, the interaction of these disciplines in his intellectual life, actually. There's a little intellectual biography story going on here, right? So let's get that story out. So once upon a time, developmental psychologists divided into two groups. This is a generalization, but we're just telling a kind of story, right? Nativists and empiricists, right? And nativists were people who thought what? About human development. Yes, please.
That you're born with the moral knowledge that
right.
you have.
Right. So actually we're tracking two things now, because in developmental psychology, these are both developmental, but this is the development of reason, and this is the development of morality. Right? Yeah, so the nativist believes you're born with your moral ideas, with your moral commitments, with your moral ideas. That either morality or moral emotions, because it could be a moral emotion. You could be a nativist two different ways. You could either believe that the actual moral beliefs are innate, or you could believe that moral emotions like sympathy, empathy, compassion, you could believe those are innate, right? So, you know, we don't have innate moral beliefs, but we're born with the capacity to experience emotions, social emotions. That's the category, right? What's an empiricist think? Oh, and likewise for reason. We're born, reason is innate in us, and it's nature. It's all there. Okay? So what do the empiricists think? Yeah, please.
Kind of like a blank slate.
That's the metaphor you need. Is tabula rasa is the fancy Latin word, a blank slate. Locke gave us the Latin phrase. And it's that experience produces it all. We become rational from our experience in the world. So this is famously the nature-nurture dichotomy. It's been a horrible thing. It's just stopped it. So years ago, that's where we were stuck. And that's where he starts his story. Everything was either nature or nurture. I was an undergraduate, and we were talking this way, and it drove me crazy. And then I was in graduate school, and I was like, it drove me crazy. Nature, nurture. What's suspicious about that dichotomy? Anybody have a hunch?
The path is not in between.
Yeah. Who says that nurture isn't happening? Who says that our experience isn't interacting with our nature as we develop? Isn't that a more plausible thing to think? So put in your notes this way. The nature-nurture dichotomy was incoherent. It didn't leave open the possibility that it's an interaction. Hello, right? You know. So anytime somebody says, well, it's like nature or nurture, which is it? You just need to throw something at them. I mean, it's just like, no, sorry, that's my frustration speaking. So Piaget was a big improvement, because Piaget gave us an alternative to the nature-nurture dichotomy, which was pretty hopeless. Piaget said this: normal brains have a program that's unfolding through development. That's what nature gave us. It's like the metaphor is like a program that's going to unfold. But it only unfolds properly in the right environment. So you need both, okay? Fair enough. The analog for your notes is to language. Does anybody remember this horrible story about a woman in California who was kept in a room for the first 12 years of her life? Have you ever heard stories like that? Well, that was a true one. And one of the things we learned in linguistics is that from this case, you know, this was a horribly abused woman, and so she wasn't exposed to language, but she was a normal, she was born as a normal individual. And so at 12, they started to try to teach her language. And she could get some language, but she had missed a critical period for language development. That's how we learned that there's this critical period
in the unfolding of your innate language program, right? Because you really do have a language acquisition module in your brain of some sort, right? And we know from anthropology that there were precursors to our species that didn't have this, right? So that's the example. Like language, it's both. And so you have to have the innate capacity, and it has to be stimulated in your environment. In the case of language, at a critical period. And if you don't get it then, you're not going to be using language the way that the other humans do, right? So that's kind of my example. That's kind of an example I would give to go along with this rationalist model. So put it in your notes. Rationalists get us past nature and nurture by positing both. Okay, the next step in the story is to go from Piaget to Kohlberg. What's the difference between Piaget and Kohlberg? Anybody ran into Piaget in their studies yet?
Could you quickly repeat what you just said?
Remind me a little bit. I'm kind of moving on.
Rationalism
gets us past the nature and nurture false dichotomy. Mm-hmm. Was there some more of that?
It's just an in between.
Yeah. It's both. Okay, so Piaget was a developmental psychologist. He was interested in, anybody remember the thing about the water, putting the water, could somebody explain that? Yeah, please. Up to what age? Do you remember? 5 or 6, was it?
I think 4.
Yeah. Do you remember that? Okay, so that's called conservation of mass. When you understand that something poured into a taller glass isn't more, it's the same amount. You do it right in front of the kid. And it turns out like 4 or 5 year olds say, oh, there's more water in the tall glass. So there's a critical point which put it in your notes this way. Piaget found these critical points at which we consolidate an understanding of reality, right? It's reason unfold. Oh, this is how the world works. Another one had to do with an object going behind a screen, right? If you're really young, you're surprised when the object comes out the other side. And you can use the startle reflex. You could watch the kids and say, oh, look, they're surprised when the object comes from behind the screen. At a certain age, it's like, you know, you guys wouldn't be so excited about that, right? And you're like, yeah, I think I understand what's going on there. The object's always there. Okay? So Piaget is understanding that. What's Kohlberg? Oh, please, question or comment?
Sure. So, like, Piaget, we learned about development through, like, physical properties of the world versus, like, Kohlberg does it through social properties.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, that's an interesting contrast because it's also, right, because Kohlberg's going to ask these stories, like the Heinz story, right? And because with morality, if you're asking about developmental morality, you know, as Kohlberg was, you're not worried about object permanence and conservation of mass. You're wondering how does our development, what stages of moral development do we go through just as we go through stages of development of our understanding of physical objects, okay? So put this in your notes. Kohlberg follows Piaget's example and looks for stages of moral development. And you're right, you can't do it with objects and water and cups because we're talking about morality. So what does he do? How does Kohlberg do his research? We're on now we're like on page 7 or so. What was the Heinz story? Anybody remember that? It's sort of like Haidt. He'd give these little vignettes. Of course, he did it first. Right. What was the Heinz story? Anybody remember that? A guy named Heinz is what?
Whatever
you got.
I thought that you were asking, like, what the stories were that you used. Like, you used the example of the swing and, like, he'd ask, like, if you didn't wear a school uniform.
Oh, a little bit later. We're almost there.
Okay,
yeah, we're almost there. Heinz, right.
Is this where his wife is dying and he needs a cure?
Yeah.
So he wishes he'd steal her.
Yeah, so he breaks into the chemist's office to get the drug because he can't afford it, right? So Kohlberg would put that in front of kids at different ages and say, was Heinz right or wrong to do that? And why? And he didn't care whether the person said right or wrong. He cared about the justification. Remember, justification's here now, right? And it turns out that he had a lot of evidence that suggests that people go through three stages. There's a pre-conventional stage where everything's kind of about power. There's a conventional stage where the justifications refer to rules. Oh, it's against the law to steal. Or in this case, the rules don't apply because it's not okay to let your wife die, right? You know. And or post-conventional. And we're going to study these more on, you have a reading on this for Wednesday, so I don't want to get into this too much. And the post-conventional included principle-based reasons for deciding, right? So the point for your notes is that, like Piaget, Kohlberg saw moral development as the development of reason. That's the crucial point, right? And interacting with environment. So he's beyond, he's like Piaget, he's moved beyond nurture, nature versus nurture. He wants to do exactly what Piaget did for the study of our understanding of physical reality. So he gave these little vignettes and he noticed a pattern. And this pattern is reflected in pre-conventional, conventional, post-conventional, right? And you're gonna get a lot of details on that for Wednesday. And the key point here is that Kohlberg and Piaget both thought they were describing something that was universal and culturally independent. Let's get that in your notes. The rationalists got past nature and nurture, but they still thought they were finding a structure that was the same in every human being, no matter where or when they lived. And that, okay, I'll give you a chance to take that in. Right? And that's a crucial assumption that Haidt rejects in the course of this intellectual journey that he takes. It might turn out that, well, we'll get the story. Let's just do the story. Okay. So Turiel was in the same tradition as Kohlberg. Turiel is a rationalist moral psychologist, developmental moral psychologist. And he innovated Kohlberg's model by doing a different kind of research method. He would. Does anybody remember some of Turiel's prompts? Turiel's prompts, like, do you remember one?
He would be asked if it was okay to do something, and then if it was okay if a teacher gave permission to do something.
So a kid shows up at school without a uniform.
Yeah.
Would that be an example?
It was kind of like a.
Or you have a different
like rule-based questions.
Yeah, right. Right. So you want to know, is it right?
Other areas as well.
Right. Good.
Harm, like you focused on whether or not rules applied as soon as it became to like when other people started getting.
Let's do a concrete example. Kid shows up at school without a uniform. There's a rule. You have to have a uniform. Did you do something wrong? Yes. What if the teacher said it was okay not to wear a uniform? Would he still be doing something wrong? So these are probe questions where you're trying to do exactly what you said. You're trying to get at whether the justification, what the justification refers to. Is it just wrong, period, no matter who in authority says otherwise? So parallel story. Joe pushes Mary off the swing. Is it wrong? Yeah. If the teacher said it was okay to push Mary off the spring, would that make it right?
No.
Right? So what you find out is that very young, this is the result from Turiel that you need, very young kids operate with a harm convention distinction. Things that harm people, I'll let you write. Very young kids operate with a harm convention distinction. In the notes here. Kids don't treat all morals the same way. Very young kids distinguish harms from social conventions. So Turiel said, wow, I found a stage. I found a really important stage. Kohlberg missed it. Harm is first on the scene in our development. Right? And so Haidt's not happy with that. Because he's been reading ethnographies. That's another discipline we've got in here. Ethnographies are accounts of ethnic cultures written by anthropologists, which just attempt to reveal how culture works, right? And so Haidt had been reading ethnographies, and these ethnographies suggested that really cool stuff. I mean, the thing about witches comes into play here. Here's the point for your notes. Ethnography suggested that people I don't want to make it about superstition. Hang on, I want to get to a little more general. That
Beer?
Yeah, I want to be even more. Let's see. I want to be even more general than that. That people use all kinds of thinking in their moral commitments. They use thinking about cleanliness. They use thinking about purity. They use thinking about that people use a rich range of cultural reference points to determine what's right or wrong. That's a new thing on the scene, because the old model was it's all rational developmental moral psychology. It's like we're just watching something unfold that would unfold the same way in any culture at any time. So the big news for Haidt is to come to the conclusion from his ethnographies that and he's reading Schrader here. Let's go to page 11 and 13 for examples. I guess a way to put it is that the ethnographies taught him that ethics relies on a culturally thick description, right? So unlike the philosophers who thought ethics didn't rely on culture at all, Haidt and Schrader and all these people, he's being pushed toward the idea that ethics really depends upon a thick cultural description. You can't just talk about it in terms of harm versus convention, okay? And one example of that is witches. Did you find the witch thing interesting? It's interesting that people tell stories about witches in similar ways across different cultures, and avoiding being a witch is a part of the worldview of a lot of cultures that have superstitions about witches. There were some other examples here. Let's just give you a minute to come up with some of these others. Yeah, this is where the superstition point comes in, right? So, bottom of page 12, it turns out that the way people, it might be that the way people work out their morality depends upon a whole range of things, including superstitions, beliefs about cosmologies, beliefs about where society came from, and so on. So that was his suspicion, was that. Morality wasn't just about reason. It wasn't just about harm versus conventions. And the way this played out, he learned from Schrader that sociocentric cultures vary in many ways from individualistic cultures. Right? So he started to think, wow, what I need to do is test Turiel's claim that very young kids work with a harm convention distinction. I need to test it by going outside of individualistic Western cultures. All Turiel did was ask, American kids this. So he set up these two cross-cultural research experiences, one involving Orissa, India, versus U.S. I think his reference city was Chicago or something. I get these parts confused. And the second international research experience he had to do with working with a Brazilian researcher using two cities in Brazil and two cities in the U.S., right? And what they did was put lots of items in front of people and ask them, is this wrong? Is it wrong no matter what? Or is it just wrong because it harms people? In other words, and so you get this distinction for the India. This is page 16, if you're following along. Right? So, right. So these are Indians from India, right? So Indians and Americans agree that these things are wrong. Just kicking a dog. Or not giving a promised reward. Both cultures agreed that those things are wrong. Americans said these things were wrong, but Indians thought it was acceptable, right? That that's a pretty harsh one, right? So harm, it just doesn't sound like harm's really operating here, because Indians thought it would be okay to beat the woman. And notice we're not doing justifications here, we're just collecting data, okay, so nobody's... and it's not just about harms versus conventions. Right? There's no harm, really. The reason in one culture it's okay for a 25-year-old son to call his father by his first name, that doesn't have anything to do with harms, right? Or if you think that's wrong, it's not because you think it's a horror, it's just a convention. The Indians who said it was wrong thought it was just wrong. They didn't say, oh, it's wrong because we have a social convention against calling your father by his first name. You see the point? Put it in your notes this way. The harm convention distinction didn't seem to explain the results. The harm convention distinction just didn't seem to explain the results. It looked more like in the individualistic culture it was harm convention, but in the sociocentric culture it was almost anything: cleanliness, views about women, views about menstruation as pollution. You know, there's a lot of attitudes, views about authority. But again, not a convention about authority, right? So he seemed to have shown that Turiel's harm convention distinction worked, but it didn't travel well. That's the slogan you need for your notes. Turiel was right for individualistic Americans, individualistic Europeans, even upper class, wealthier Brazilians who became more individualistic. And so there's also a social class variable. High social, high economic Brazilians were more like the Americans because social class moved them more toward individualism. Isn't that interesting? So what he's seeing is how culture comes into play in shaping our moral commitments. Okay? Notice, by the way, this is a little caveat. You've got to put it in the margin or on the side. He's not saying that there is no way to justify moral values. Notice that's a project of justification. He's just saying you can't explain morality without referring to culture. That's really important distinction. I'm going to say it again. He's not espousing cultural relativism in Singer's sense. Remember Singer talked about relativism? He's not saying, oh, look, morality varies by culture, so there's no way to justify a moral belief. That's moral cultural relativism. But that's part of a justification project. He's just trying to explain how morality works, and he believes the moral psychologist got it wrong. It's not all about harm versus convention. Maybe it is in individualistic cultures, but it isn't here. So I don't want you to get the wrong impression. Haidt isn't saying there's no way to justify moral values because it varies by culture. That's cultural relativism. It's not a very promising position, frankly. But what's cool is that he's taking on the idea that you can't understand ethics unless you accept that culture plays a really big role. So now we're somewhere between explanations of ethics and cultural relativism. Yeah, Laura, you had a question?
Were you saying that as people moved up within their class system, within their society,
right, that
the money was bringing them more towards individualism or the westernization?
It's hard to say. Yeah, that's
okay.
A further story. But it could be the money, could be that they're participating in a more individualistic subculture
of
successful, you know, upper middle class people. Yeah, there's a further story there. Okay, good. Other questions? At this point? Yeah.
Good. Okay, we're almost ready for groups. We're going to leave you about 15-20 minutes to do this exercise. So we're getting the story out. You know, we got the background story here. Then we got Kohlberg, Turiel. Height's puzzled about Turiel. Is Turiel right? Is he right apart from all these ethnographies I'm reading? They seem to suggest it's not that simple. So the more sociocentric you are, the less likely you are to distinguish morality as harm from morality as convention. This is the key. This is a key way to put the conclusion. The morality convention distinction was itself culturally variable. And I kind of want to make this concrete with us right now. Maybe you guys have examples. How many of you grew up in a household where you were not supposed to wear shoes beyond the front door? That's not the way the house I grew up in was, but that's the way our house was when we had kids. And you know, so it's also interesting. The interesting thing about culture is you can start cultural practices. I've asked my sons this. They both plan on continuing that rule in their later life. How many of you grew up with other kinds of cleanliness, appropriateness kinds of things like that? Yeah.
My dad, when my sister and I were little, he would always make us tie our hair back when we ate dinner.
That's interesting.
Right. He hated watching it like it.
Yeah, that's interesting. Right. Notice it's a cleanliness thing that gets transcribed as kind of etiquette, but also like, oh, that's not appropriate behavior. You know. So did you take
he
that
did
on?
That if we did. I mean, like he was nice. But if we were like, I don't want to, he'd be like, no, you're gonna.
Because he had this, and some of these are just our little tics, like they're obsessions about cleanliness that we have. Like how many of you I don't ask for show of hands, but think about how many of you routinely, you know, go wash your hands before you sit down to eat, you know. Those habits in a culture where food is served the way our culture is, those habits have changed. Like, you know, when I was a kid, you would not have driven down the highway with a hamburger between your legs, you know, that would just be like a little gross. But that's kind of how we get food now. We get it from a drive-up window and we stick it between our legs, or we put it on the console and we drive with it. Even eating in a car like grossed my parents out when drive-ins started. My parents were like disgusted. They were morally disgusted that people were going to eat food in their cars. They just didn't get into the whole thing. That's a little extreme. But, you know, you could ask yourself this. Would you eat your burrito in a public bathroom? If you saw someone eating a burrito in a public bathroom, what would you think of that person? Would you go on a date with that person? No, maybe. I don't know. Maybe you'd get your burrito out. Well, if you're in a public bathroom. Well, no, wait. The whole example's gotten really complicated all of a sudden. So there's a lot of things like that. There are a lot of cultures where it would be shocking if a man walked into the kitchen while a woman was preparing dinner. It would be ruining the dinner. You see what I mean? So that's a way of pumping your intuitions about how ethics might be connected to non-moral attitudes and cultural values. Another dimension is in sociocentric cultures. The key inversion is that the importance of cohesiveness of the group, put this in your notes on this, wherever you have this, the importance of cohesiveness to the group takes precedence over the importance of the individual's preferences. Right? Group over individual. Individualistic cultures tend to be somewhat libertarian. If you're not hurting somebody, it could still be wrong, but it's just a rule that's making it wrong. Right? Turiel, right? Harm versus convention. Okay, so here's what I'm going to ask you to do in your groups. I think a good paragraph on this question is going to do a few things. I'm going to try and make it a little formulaic just to kind of get a little bit of standardization in here. So for your paragraphs, I'm going to suggest that you come up with a topic statement that kind of tells me what's coming in the paragraph. And remember, this is a paragraph about key lessons from the story that I just rehearsed with you. Then I think you're going to have your key lessons. I'd put one in, you know, one per sentence. I'm not sure how many your group is going to identify. As long as they're key lessons, I'm going to be pretty happy. And then I'm going to ask you to try to come up with a significance statement. And just something that kind of states how these lessons change our picture of morality, right? Because that's what they are. They're all lessons in adopting a different perspective about what morality is or how to explain it. So that's kind of a sentence plan, and maybe that helps kind of in the formulation. Questions about that? Okay, let's get into groups. I'm going to ask you to do that. I'm going to ask you to have one scribe. I only want to hear one result from each group. And I'm going to ask the scribe, ideally each group has somebody with a device that could type this out. And I'm going to ask the scribe to use the small group discussion report form. Just your group name, one paragraph for the answer. Okay? Can we get to work on that? We have plenty of time. You should be able to write this and submit it before you leave. Okay? Oh. That's okay. Feel free to go to the bathroom if you need to, whatever you need to do.